In less reserving, you have to be prepared for all sorts of unusual developments, like relocation of the rooms at the last moment. So I apologize for the confusion in that. And hopefully, we'll be back on track. Let me first introduce Chuck Emma. Chuck is principal and consultant at Pinnacle Actuarial Resources. He's chairman of the Academy's Committee on Financial Soundness and Risk Management, and he has lots of experience in doing insurer loss reserve studies. To Chuck's right is Tom Ryan. He's principal and consulting actuary at Milliman. He is the chairman of the CIS Committee on Reserves, and he has also been involved in many insurer loss reserve studies. My name is John Kolar. I'm vice president at ISO, and I'm also the new vice president of risk integration in ERM. That's quite a mouthful. And we'll see how that evolves, okay? And just to say it right up front, you're doing reserving, you're doing risk management, okay? So just keep that in mind and join the joint section, okay? Because that's going to expand, you know, your view of loss reserving and managing risk. At ISO, I get involved in the industry loss reserve study that we do every year or 2 years, and the development of tools such as customized loss reserving tool that we just recently developed. And some of the analysis will be based on that. So I'm going to start, okay, and then Tom and Chuck will follow. And if we do it right, there'll be some time for questions. So we'll ask you to, you know, to hold the questions till the end, unless it's you really think it's just a clarifying question. Okay, but we want to make sure we get all the presentations done. There are some, or were some, copies in the back of the room. The presentations will be up on the website. So, as a matter of fact, some of them may be up now. I'm not sure, but I know that some of them have been supplied. My presentation breaks down into two parts. One is the industry Schedule P study that ISO does every year or 2 years, and then also some analysis of direct losses. Some of this stuff I'll go through very quickly. It's in the handouts and everything. You can look at it. These are just parameters. We'll mention that Schedule P data and was compiled by AM Best. Line study, well, typical Schedule P lines. Some key points. One thing that's very important is the numbers that you'll see are excluding environmental and asbestos, and we figure that's in the $30 to $50 billion range, but we typically keep it out of our analysis. Link ratio approaches. Data quality, always an issue, always a concern. Conventions, when we talk about, you know, we show a positive number, that's a deficiency. So negative is a possible redundancy. So here are the results. Okay, on all lines basis, you can see, not as large a deficiency as we've seen in the past. Want to put it in perspective a little bit. Reserves were about 3 percentage points more adequate at year end 2004 than at year end 2003 when we last studied the industry reserves. They're about 11 percentage points more adequate at year-end 2004 than at year-end 2001. Lines with deficiencies, okay. Products, occurrence policies, commercial multi-peril, so forth. Reinsurance, non-proportional, pretty large numbers. Workers' comp numbers, we actually talked to the NCCI and some other people to see if we're in the same ballpark.
Clarify the pain in the case that isn't with pain, triangles in the case of the case incurred, is that the difference?
Yes, exactly. Right. Here's the results for the other lines. I want to point out right away that the Med Mal numbers, we're still not comfortable with them. We're continuing to check them out, and we'll hopefully finalize them within the next couple of weeks. Okay. But that's important to note. The other numbers are pretty much set, and again, we'll be releasing them in the next couple of weeks. From 6 years, 1996 through 2001, the reserve adequacy actually deteriorated, and you'll see the accident year numbers, which is the solid line, are above the calendar year numbers. And then the situation started to improve here in 2002. So we've had, you know, 3 years of strengthening now. Another thing that we've noticed, you know, over the years in looking at this is that in years where, and this is the broken line, you know, where the industry had positive or good returns, I should say high returns, that's when reserve strengthening generally takes place. So this fairly decent match here. There's some aberrations like due to 9/11 and so forth, you know, kind of catastrophe losses will come in and have an impact if they're near the end of the year or something, or there's some uncertainty involved. On a discounted basis, things are pretty good right now, okay? And but there were some years from 2000 to 2003 that on a, you know, on a discounted basis, the reserves were still inadequate. Now I'd like to spend a little bit more time on the second part of the presentation and, you know, analysis of direct losses. Schedule P was net. Now we're looking at some direct losses, you know, based on the data that ISO collects. And we're gonna look at some, you know, talk about segment analysis a little bit, then we'll talk some about, I should say segment analysis, you know, we're talking about maybe you're looking at a particular coverage or a class group, something along those lines. The reserving and benchmarking, what we try to do, you know, playing around with some of the data we have is coming up with comparable mixes of business, let's say using the industry data in comparison to what an individual company has in their data. And so this is an ongoing project, if you will. We're spending more and more time on this. Tail factors, you know, we've done, taking a look at some of the data and that, get into that a little more, and confidence intervals. These are the lines, because ISO collects data in certain fashions, you know, we had to sort of do some mapping, if you will, in how we dealt with the data. So, you know, for example, we have the homeowners is typically what we're looking at, and typically not including the farm owners data. Could do that, but not right now. And the same follows through. In some cases, we have things broken down a little further, like we have commercial multi-peril, liability and property separately. Some more lines as well, and so forth. Now, looking at the segment analysis, the first thing we did is we, you know, we have some Schedule P data here, if you will, other liability, and you know, these are the link ratios that we generated from that analysis. And then we try to look at some of the pieces that went into Schedule P and so forth, and you'll see there are different prem ops tables and so forth, and we did some combining them and so, et cetera. And one of the things, composite rated risks, of course, is in other liability, but not here. So there's, you know, it's not perfectly apples to apples comparison, so I'll question you about that for a couple of reasons. One is net versus direct. The Schedule P over here is net, everything else is direct. And there's some, you know, different mixes of data in some of the other bars, if you will. Also, the evaluations, in this particular slide, we're talking about losses evaluated as of 15 months, 27 months, and so forth, in contrast to, you know, 12, 24, and so forth in the annual statement. So. Now, we use the, as I said, the aggregate direct data and by segment to do some of this analysis and that, and again, looking at it and being able to break it down into various segments and so forth, depending on what we were trying to do or what a company would want to do. Paid incurred data, losses, and claims, claim counts, if you will, loss adjustment expenses. So, you know, we've been playing around with slicing and dicing it a lot of different ways to see, you know, it seems to work pretty well. In putting the data together, you know, one of the things we struggle with is a little bit was, well, gee, you know, it does seem like a big deal, but, you know, you're going to weigh your link ratios or do you take your losses directly and add them up? And we decided to do the losses. You can get different answers, okay, but we'll to us, the best way to do it was the losses. So if we're using industry data, we would, you know, a company had, you know, maybe 10%. What we do, by the way, is typically we're not going to use a company's data directly or present their results. We'll sometimes take, you know, several companies, put them together, construct a new company, so we're not ever talking about any individual company. But basically, you know, we took the losses and, you know, we would weigh them together using this constructed company's distribution of business. And then generate length ratios from that point on. And doing it separately for each accident year as well, because companies can obviously change mix of business, you know, getting into this group, class of business, out of that class, et cetera. And then, you know, we just to show you what it looked like, that's all. You know, we took the regular triangles and everything and filled them out. Sometimes mixing, you know, the ISO, the industry data, if you will, with the company's data, you know, you can credibility weigh it in many ways. And we're actually looking at some ways of, you know, credibility weighing the data that with companies that may be more homogeneous. And when I say companies, I mean a group that's mixed together. And then we came up with some averages and so forth, you know, 2 years or 3 years, 5 years, best 3 or 5, or how we want to characterize it. So, you know, in doing some of that benchmarking and everything, you know, we looked at, you know, some maybe 10 years of data here. And in this particular example, we used the best average of 3 of 5. And just to see, you know, what the difference was. This is, you know, company's data going all the way in this particular example. And this is with some ISO factors thrown in instead, what with the company mix and that, so more of a demonstration than anything. The tail factors, typically using modified Bondi, and that we used in the Schedule P analysis that we did as well. And then we started to look at, you know, beyond 10 years, so we've moved up to 20 years. In theory, we could go a lot further. But right now we stopped at 20 for the long tail commercial lines. And we did some, again, some analysis taking a look at other liability here again, incurred losses for VI and PD combined. And just to look and see, well, gee, how different did it look for, you know, 10-year development versus if you had 20 years of data in there. And numbers look reasonably close in this particular situation. We start to play with this and everything. Obviously, depending on what time frames you look at, you'll get different answers, okay? And more to follow on that, too, at some point. Relative volatility of tail factors in one of the companies that we constructed, again, you know, we saw that insurer data, needless to say, is kind of a reasonably obvious thing, but insurers, again, that's over here, I apologize. Okay, company business either at, you know, 120 months, 10 years to ultimate, or, you know, 240 months to ultimate and everything. We actually compared that then using, let's say, the industry data. And, you know, tended to be a little more volatile, the company data, typically. As far as the tail factors. We start to play around with confidence intervals and that, so this, you know, it seems to be an area of great interest right now. So what we did is, in doing this analysis, we estimated the parameters for claim severity and frequency separately. So if you use a collective risk model type of analysis, we did it by line and by settlement lag or valuation, if you will. For severity, we went with the you know, with the industry severity distributions. We also, though, took a look at insurer size, you know, factored that in doing the frequency analysis, because that's going to make a big difference, and you'll see that momentarily. So now we, in looking at the data and doing some analysis here, we saw that the average size, which is green here, you know, would tend to increase with the longer a claim is open, That's no surprise. And the volatility as well tends to increase the longer a claim is open. And then, you know, to actually do the analysis in these created insurance company, we needed certain types of information. Obviously, we're looking at it by line and by accident year, the latest valuation for the accident year. We had to bring in the reinsurance arrangements, okay, so retention, co-insurance, you know, per claim limits and so forth. Now, before I said that the severity factors, you know, we used industry numbers, but we also recognize that, you know, what we hear a lot is we're better than the average. Matter of fact, almost everyone's better than the average. And, you know, it seems to be truth of some sort in the industry. I mean, maybe I explained some of the results some of the times. But we, recognizing that, we, you know, we created like a scale factor where you could change your average severity some to recognize, you know, that we might be different than the average. And this is just, you know, a screenshot of some of the measures of variability that we did. And, you know, we came up with like an aggregate measure here. And then something for, this is the frequency and then the severity and then, you know, the combined, if you will, the reserves, but by line and period. So then here's a, this is an illustrative graph. This wasn't based on any real data, but we wanted to show something that, you know, would get the point across. And so this is, these are totally fabricated numbers and wanted something that looked nice and pretty and you could really work with. And so you have a cumulative probability on the y-axis and the what, you know, here's the size of the reserves down here. And so you're looking at, like, in this case, a 50% confidence interval around the expected losses. And then we actually went out and we looked at, you know, some companies with and without reinsurance. And when you bring, and obviously this is why people buy reinsurance, but when you bring in the, you know, without reinsurance, you see a lot of volatility here. The, this is the expected loss here. And there's the volatility around it. And then taking a look at the same insurer with reinsurance, you see, obviously, the expected's coming down, and you're talking about a lot less volatility, and obviously, that's why people are buying it. So this is risk management, too. Another example, ERM, okay. Join the risk management section. We also wanted to take a look at size a little bit and, you know, see what difference it makes. So we took one of our created smaller insurers, and then we just took those losses and multiplied them by a factor of 15, just, you know, to see what would happen. And, you know, you could take a look, you could see here the expected here and whatever. And, you know, a lot of volatility, if you will, so pretty broad confidence intervals. And of course, then it gets a lot tighter with a lot more size. So size matters, obviously. So again, you know, the focus here was, you know, what we've done with looking at those reserving triangles, combining segments, mixing things up so we can do, you know, whatever analysis that we're trying to accomplish. You know, we'll continue to focus on, let's say, the tail factors and so forth. On occasion, we've been looking at, like, individual segments because of, you know, and some of the rate making that we're doing and so forth as well. And, you know, one of the things, you know, we felt this type of information might be helpful for, you know, for CEOs and CFOs and maybe for the board or investors, rating agencies, regulators, whatever. Going forward, we're going to spend more time, you know, drilling into this some more. I mentioned the credibility weighing already, so I won't go back to that. Glenn can tell you more about it then. He's working on it. Generation of more refined confidence intervals is something that we're going to do because we've kept that at a fairly high level now. And we can break it down into, you know, finer cuts, if you will. And we do want to do more stuff with tail factors and maybe trying to come up with some other ways of looking at it. We can build that into the analysis. And we like to spend some time on correlations and everything. You know, when you aggregate those reserves and that, you know, you can, you know, maybe it will get even tighter, tighter ranges. But the ranges can be pretty broad. I mean, I didn't focus on those numbers before, but, you know, they're not as tight as people would like them to be. I mean, that just happens to be the reality. And then we're always looking for input from people, suggestions on, gee, what would be valuable. So please, you know, please suggest it, and we appreciate that input. Now, Tom's going to come up and give his presentation.
Thanks, John. As John mentioned, I'm Tom Ryan. I'm the current chair of the CAS Committee on Reserves. And what I'd like to do this morning is sort of make my presentation into two parts. One is to give you an overview of some of the work that we're doing within the Committee on Reserves, and two, provide you a little more detail on one particular project that involves looking at the information included in the Statement of Actuarial Opinions. As John mentioned, you know, he asked that if you had any suggestions, you know, he's eagerly looking for them. The same goes for, you know, any work that we do. Part of the value of doing these sessions is to try to get input from our members. You know, there's many facets to loss reserving. If there's particular areas that we really need to focus on, well, we'd like to hear it from you. As a research committee, you know, we'll allocate whatever resources we need to address those areas. And I'll go through some of them as we go through this. So to start the first part, again, the CAS Committee on Reserves, we're a research committee. We're trying to address any deficiencies in loss reserving approaches. Loss reserving has been under the spotlight for the last few years. One part of it probably linked to a lot of fingers being pointed at loss reserves being the driver of some PC insolvencies. And probably another key element is the adverse development we're seeing as an industry over the past few years. I've summarized them here by calendar year. So for 2001, this tells you that in 2001, accident years 2000 and prior, the ultimate losses in that year developed adversely by $10 billion. The next year in 2002, $22 billion. In 2003, $14 billion. And while it looks like we're improving in 2004, that $10 billion is a little deceptive, because included in that $10 billion, if you really drill down, is actually $20 billion of adverse development on 2002 and prior, but a $10 billion favorable development for 2003. So companies are, for the latest year, and that's one of the, in the hard market in 2003, they're already recognizing favorable development in that year. And while the 2002 and prior, you know, usually it's 98 to 2002 where the problem areas are still problematic. So you're talking very big numbers recently that, you know, we need to address. There's got to be something we can relook at our approaches. So how do we look at it? The overview is really three fronts that we're moving on here. And we coined the terms pushing the envelope, bridging the gap, and shoring up the foundation. Those are our three approaches to how we can sort of help to advance the science. In the first one, pushing the envelope, what are we trying to do is, you know, we have our basic methods, but let's push the envelope. Let's see what else is out there. Are there new techniques that we can and should be using? Maybe years ago we were limited in terms of our computer power or the software that was available, but now with what's available, maybe these methods, some methods that we didn't think we could do, we can actually improve upon. So let's do what we can to get these advanced methods out there. How do we accomplish this? What are some of the things we're doing to try to push the envelope? Well, the first one is support of the Actuarial Credibility Task Force. There's a number of recommendations in that paper. And two of them that we're sort of focusing on in our support role is the special interest seminars on advanced reserving techniques, as well as helping to establish a call paper program on advanced reserving techniques. Again, focus on, let's generate some research on advanced techniques. Let's do what we can. Let's get people talking about it. Specifically, I think we really need to address the item of ranges of reserves, right? When you talk to people outside the actuarial world, they say, well, okay, we were meeting with some bankers, and they said, well, this other actuary said the reserves were in a reasonable range for workers' comp, but what does that mean? So, well, it could mean this or it could mean that, but there's no sort of standard. You know, we need to do something to be consistent among our profession and to add credibility to that, because that it's becoming more and more an important issue. We also have our 2006 call paper program for the reserves. We, probably some of you are familiar, in April we put out a call for papers. We received about 20 to 25 papers, proposals for papers, a very deep pool and a lot of quality papers there. So we're very excited about that. Those papers will be released next year at the CLRS. Sponsored research, there's money available in the CAS. We need to drill down to look at a particular issue, especially with reserving. We can go through academics, we can go through CAS members. One of the items we're kicking around now is there was a UK group that did a research report on reserving in the UK. And what they found was that there was a correlation between the market being soft or hard and the length of the development patterns and losses. In a soft market, where terms and conditions maybe got a little squishy, there was longer development. In a hard market, development shortens. Now, is that same item true here in the US? Maybe that'd be good to know. Maybe that's something we can sort of try to quantify those parameters. So that's something we're thinking about doing sponsored research on. And other, again, we're looking for any ideas, and if anybody has any, we'd love to hear them. So pushing the envelope, let's try to get some more advanced techniques. Bridging the gap. There is a lot of great stuff out there already. Sometimes it's just hard to understand what it is, you know. And sometimes I'll read through these papers and it's more symbols than words, and you try to figure out, okay, now what does this really mean? And you have to sort of step back and try to understand the forest and the trees, right? How does this work? What is this telling me? And then how can I use this? So those are really the three things we need to address. We have to make members more aware of what research is really out there. We have to, you know, we're enhancing the CES website to try to help make better searches so it's easier to find this information and help you to understand really what's in there and how to use it. We have to translate this research and hopefully facilitate some practical applications. And not only do we have, once we have the paper, but have the authors, and this is one of our goals for the new Call People program, really put into a practical application, here's how you use it, whether it's they append an Excel sheet or something to it that people can play around and use it to really get your hands into it to understand, oh, that's what this is doing, and this is more importantly how I can use it in my practice. And finally, the third sort of prong here is shoring up the foundation. You know, the majority of actuaries, if you look at most of the reserve studies, we still rely on, you know, the chain ladder, the BF method, and they're great methods, but we just have to make sure we're applying them correctly and we're leveraging them the right way. One of the things, item number two here, is a working party that we sponsor through the CS Committee on Reserves. One, to address tail factors. How are people calculating their tail factors? What are pros and cons of each method? What are alternative sources you can use? Same thing with the Born-Hinder-Ferguson, and a critical part of that is the expected loss ratio. And looking at it, I get to see a lot of these retrospective looks at the reserves, and I can't tell you how many of them come down that we've seen a tremendous amount of adverse development come into that initial, some people call it the seed ratio, the initial a priori ratio that people use. In the soft market, they're very optimistic, and that's led to a lot of this adverse development. So those, and I would invite you, there's a session tomorrow morning on these two working parties, sort of bringing you up to speed what they've seen. The papers will be coming out, I believe, at the next forum, to summarize their work, but it's a lot of interesting stuff, and it's really key, and these are methods that people use all the time. The call paper program, again, we've gotten some papers that build upon the chain ladder and the BF, looking at them different ways. I think they'll be very interesting to all of us. And finally, what I put down is TFORB. This used to be a subcommittee of the Committee on Reserves. It's the Task Force on Reserving Principles, taking a fresh look at the reserving principles that are out there, understanding what those are, and how we can sort of build upon those for the standards of practice. So through those things, we're hoping to, again, shore up the foundation so we're starting at the right level. Moving on to the second part of the presentation, this is a particular project we're working on, nicknamed EARL, or Under-Reserving Insolvency Lane. Now this came about, I think it's about 2 or 3 years ago, when there was an article by one of the rating agencies pointing to reserve inadequacy as the leading cause of P&C insolvency. So, well, gosh, as the Committee on Reserves, you should probably know, is that an accurate statement? How are they measuring it? And maybe if we do almost like an autopsy of some of these companies, we can figure out what were some of the issues involved and what, again, looking to what can we do to improve in the future. But in terms of insolvencies, as I don't know if any of you have dealt with them, but it's tough to get information once the company's gotten solvent. There's a lot of legal issues involved. A lot of the in-house technology that was there has moved on. The reports are hard to get your hands on, but we basically gathered a lot of statement of opinions, annual statements, some newspaper articles, but we couldn't really put it all together to try to figure out really, gosh, what went wrong on some of these items. So as sort of an outgrowth of that initial perspective. We said, well, at the end of the day, we do have all these statement of actuarial opinions for these insolvent companies. Maybe there's some value to looking through here and saying, is there any trends or patterns that we see, or even how good was that information that we were putting into those opinions before the company went insolvent? And in fact, let's even broaden the scope. And now we'll look at these insolvent companies, but let's look at companies that have had large adverse development that are still ongoing in the last few years. Is there some pattern that we see in both of those groups? And maybe that helps us to tell something for the future. So just to summarize here, what we wanted to do is try to measure the quality of the information that were in the opinions. Were there any problems that are identified? And we'll try to keep this as objective as possible. We came up with a template, and we said, let's pick up some data points of the opinion. Keep it very straightforward. Who signed the opinion? Was it an FCAS, an ACAS, or a loss reserve specialist? When were they appointed? Was it very recently? Was it a change in actuary? Are they a consultant? Were they in-house? Were there mentioned A&E issues? Were there mentioned anything, issues about chance of material adverse development? All these things we try to come up with sort of a code, 0, 1, 2, 3, that would allow us to aggregate it on a basis. So we gathered a bunch of SAOs. We were able to use some contacts from the NIC to grab a bunch of insolvent companies from the 1999 to 2000, their opinions, as well as ongoing companies with reserve changes from 2000 to 2003, aggregate all this data. Now, we didn't want to look at it in a vacuum because, you know, if you look at, let's say, for example, looked at the number of associates who had signed opinions, and 75% of the companies that went insolvent had associates were designers. Well, that could tell you one thing, but then if you looked at the sort of the universe of opinions, and it was 90% were signed by associates, it would tell you something very different. So what we also wanted to do was get sort of a universe of opinions, see if we can get that to sort of match our data against, and then draw some conclusions. So just to give you the status on the insolvent companies, we gathered the opinions, we input the data, same thing on the ongoing companies. Those were about 50 of them. What we tried to get was not just the year before the adverse development or the insolvency, but up to 3 years before, so we could sort of track if there were any changes there. The trigger for the ongoing companies, it had to be at a large material dollar-wise and absolute value in terms of reserve change, as well as a percentage of the reserves and a percentage of surplus, so sort of a dual trigger to make our company selection. For the industry, we were fortunate to get a contact in one of the state insurance departments who look at over 900 opinions a year. So that was a pretty sizable database that they gave us. And they did track, fortunately, a lot of the same material, a lot of the same data items that we were tracking. So, and I'll show you that in a minute, how some of the things line up. So here are some of the statistics. The first one is, was there a change in the signer of the opinion the year right before the insolvency? You know, were they shopping the reserve around, they got a signer, then something happened. So what we did, just the way these graphs are structured, so you'll know going forward, is the yellow is a bar graph representing all the insolvent companies. So even though we show it in 1998, it's really a composite of 1990 to 2000, but we just put it into 1 year so you can just see what that was. For the ongoing companies that had reserve adverse development, we put it in the blue bar graph at 2003. So it's the insolvencies on the left, and the blue actually represents probably like 2000 to 2003, again, a composite of those years. Now the line graph is the actual data from the state insurance department. So for example, let's look at this one, change in signer. 26% of companies that went insolvent in that data, they changed the signer the year before. So is that a big number or not? But if you look at from the department, in 1998, it was only about 15%. So maybe more changed. But when you look at what happened in 1999 and 2000, it actually goes up to almost 25% as well. So again, one of those items where initially 25% sounds like a lot, but when you look at the industry, well, gosh, about a quarter of actuaries, they change the signer. Now, just to clarify, when we say change signers, that means if you were an actuary, two different actuaries in the same company, we didn't count that as a change. So if they kept it in-house, that wasn't a change. But if they changed consulting firms, so they went from in-house to a consulting firm or the opposite, that counted as a change. So you can see it's about 20%, and then coming down, it's almost oddly correlated to maybe the market there. It seems like they change more in the soft market than in the hard market. Coming down again, not a lot of changes. Was the signer outside the company? A lot in this debate about reserves, you'll hear some people say, well, gosh, the signer should always be outside the company so they're independent. I guess independent as much as their fees are being paid by the company is debatable. The other side, you say, well, there's, if the person inside signs it, gosh, he's under so much pressure. So it's interesting to look at this, and that, and again, I'll explain this in a minute. Overall, this is the interesting one, is about 50% are inside, are signed by in-house actuaries, and 50% of opinions are sound by consultants. That's an interesting statistic to note. We look at the insolvencies, about 86% were signed by consultants. Now, the reason I have to explain that is because most of these companies that went insolvent are smaller PNC companies. So they're not going to have in-house actuaries. They're going to have consultants, and that's why that's so high. Conversely, the big companies that we've seen a lot of major adverse development in the last few years, those are they're big companies that have a big actuarial staff. So as you'd expect, about half of them have internal people signing the paper. So that's really consistent with the industry. So overall, about 50% of signers are in-house and 50% are outside. This is a great statistic in terms of, did the company fail the IRIS ratio, the one-year development test, the year before they went insolvent or the year before they had the development? Now first look at the industry. It's under 10% and it's pretty consistently flat down there. But look at what happens for the companies that went insolvent. The year before, half of them failed that one-year test. Look at the ongoing companies, a quarter of them failed tests. This really jumps out at you as saying, well gosh, sometimes that is a good signal. It's something, you know, it's not just a one-time event. There may be something on the horizon. Does that also happen on the two-year test? And it does as well, about 40. And again, this is sort of influenced by the one-year development, but you have, again, a very flat industry, less than 20%, and then the insolvency is a huge number, experienced a big adverse movement prior to the insolvency. Were there reconciliation issues? This is something we thought about. Are people facing a lot of data problems? Is that really driving it? Well, the graph looks like it has a lot of volatility. If you look at the actual percentages, it's really less than 10% is the highest one. So we're talking 2% of insolvencies, 4%. This is where the actuary consciously puts in the opinion, yeah, I had problems with reconciliation or there were data issues. It's really not a big issue. You're not seeing it on an ongoing basis. 4 to 5% of companies are saying they have any kind of data issues there. So it's not, we were thinking, oh gosh, maybe they'll see a big blip in this data issue, but that's really not, doesn't seem to be a problem. Comment on chance of material adverse deviation. Again, this I have to comment on, is this really didn't come into play until 2000 and prior. So again, our insolvencies were from 1999 to 2000. So we try to throw away those that were before you had the chance to comment on. Was there a chance, you know, in the opinion, did you say, yes, there's a chance of material adverse deviation? Of the companies that went insolvent, the year before they went insolvent, about 10% of the companies said, yes, there's a chance of material adverse deviation. When you look at the industry starting in 2000, it hovers from 4 to 10%. And the companies that had the large material adverse deviation, only 4% of them said there was a chance of that happening the year before it happened. You know, I think probably as we move on, we're going to see a lot more, that this graph is going to shoot up here as more people realize how volatile reserves are and what the results have been. Was the opinion reasonable? Some people talk about clean opinions, but that's not really a technical type of opinion. Is really, did the actuary signing it say, yes, the reserves are a reasonable provision for the liabilities? They have to say that straight out. And this one is kind of interesting in that on the industry, it sort of hovers around 92-90% saying that the actuaries who signed it said, yeah, we think things are reasonable. But for the insolvent companies, 86% said it was reasonable. So 14% of them pointed out that, wait, you know, maybe things are reasonable. There's some issues there. So, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a lot when you see compared to most of the other points. And in fact, here, 95%, 96% of the ongoing companies were the opinions contained the wording that it was reasonable. Were people using finite reinsurance? This was a very small issue in the insolvencies. There was no comment on whether they were ceding or assuming. It's interesting how you can see the use of finite, again, maybe stepping back from the industry and seeing how many more companies are involved in, as you spike up here to 2000, 2003. It doesn't, again, appear to be too much of an issue. Here, they seem to be, the companies with the large adverse deviation seem to be right in line with the other ones. But maybe more the use of finite, it's interesting to see how that's trailed upwards and now down. So that's what I have for now. I guess what we're trying to do, again, is continue our work in these areas. We're trying to post as much as we can on the website, but we definitely are looking for feedback in terms of what can we work on in the future, where can we add the most value. With that, I'll turn it over to Chuck.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you. I would contrast, I guess I'd start by describing a little more what we're doing in professional research. As John mentioned in the introduction, I'm chairing an American Academy committee on financial soundness and risk management. Just so everybody understands, the Academy is generally for the areas of public policy. In contrast to what Tom's been doing in the CAS, that's a little more about research. But yeah, frankly, what we've been doing has been complementary and really the same kind of thing lately. What we're doing is responding to issues and really public scrutiny that that has existed over really the most significantly over the last 2 years in the area of loss reserving. And so what I'll tell you a little about is what we've encountered and really some research we've done in response to the issues regarding loss reserve developments in the industry. But I think it's important to at least give some background to the matter. I think in my mind, it goes back about 2 years ago to the CAS meeting in November of 2003 in New Orleans. We had a casualty practice council meeting. And at that point, and this was really, the timing was quite interesting. At that point, there was continual concern, at least, well, I say an emerging concern at that point, about loss reserves and the opinions and what good is this serving our profession. There was a note that there's something like 2,000 or so opinions out there, and you know, pretty much all of them have reasonable language, as it's called sometimes, clean opinions. It's rare we're having adverse opinions actually filed. Yet there are indications that the industry was significantly under reserved, and so got similar to what John's talking about. Everybody's a little better than average. I guess there's just one really, really, really bad company out there dragging us all down, but we yet to bang that one. Anyway, the real concern is there was a public perception concern growing at that point. I think Mary Frances Miller was the person to really put that into my head as a concern for our committee. Well, lo and behold, about a week later, just before Thanksgiving weekend, boom, the article had come out in Standard & Poor's articles. And not to over-highlight that article, because there have been many critical articles, many concerns by a lot of different people in the industry. But I think that's probably the most significant article, and I will confess to being a little mixed. I don't want to overemphasize an article that was written 2 years ago. We've got lots of other things to be worried about. But it did put into light a public relations challenge, and really an educational challenge more than anything for our profession. And you know, it's important that we respond properly to it. So it's important also to examine, in my presentation we'll talk a lot about what they said and in terms of how we relate and educate people. I think we need to continue to examine what's out there and what questions really need to be answered and in what manner. So anyway, the background for this matter is quite significant, and there have been tremendous amount of press on failures and impairments and many downgrades than ever before. The reserve developments have continued quite significantly, and in fact, what I will show you is some of the data we had looked at for year ends 02, 03, and 04. And compounding that over time is about $45 billion of adverse loss reserve developments, just straight industry reported data. And so that's just, you know, that's just a factual number, and by any account, $45 billion is a pretty significant number, and particularly when we get into the area of public perception. So we really need to examine what's going on. Is it happening at across the industry? What's it attributed to? Is it a small number of companies? And what's the role of actuarial practice? How are actuaries factoring into this matter? So let's go back to what the folks out on the outside were saying. You know, what are they saying about us, and why do they care? Well, these are some of the statements. You can read them for yourself that were made in that article, in the November 2003 article. And it seems interesting, that middle one really is the one I think that was highlighted yesterday in the general session panel. I think this is the one that really got people a little riled up. It's really saying whether naivete or knavery, reserve additions that undermine confidence and estimates. So you're either dumb or you're a crook, or both, or something. I mean, that's the thing that got the Academy onto an immediate response. And so naturally the debate was ongoing, but I think as Steve Darcy had tried to get everybody going, he had said, this is a tremendous opportunity for education. So we look at what the outsiders want from this thing, and it seems to boil down to, even though we sign opinions that say these are for regulatory purposes only, there are outsiders that have no other means of looking at these things called reserves, and they don't give a darn about our caveats. They want to know whether or not they can be comfortable with these reserves so they don't disturb the earnings projection. So it's a very much a narrower level of concern and a narrower level of tolerance for developments in reserves. I mean, from a financial and regulatory standpoint, it's quite significant we have companies getting impaired. But even more significantly, the outside financial community is looking for a very high degree of precision that I would contend in most cases isn't there. So, but you know, again, we're dealing with a group that is looking at regulatory document as some way of getting comfortable with earnings. Okay, what were some of the real issues here? You know, some of the points obviously in those articles had merit. I mean, there's no denying that the developments were significant, and in some cases you could argue that the methods and failures, you know, could in some circumstances have been a problem with regarding actuarial practice. But the real problem with the reasoning, the problem I had was with the reasoning, it stampeded from a basic observation of reserves are developing. Well, of course, they're developing. And therefore, actuaries are screwing up. Obviously, that seems to take quite a gigantic leap. And so what we wanted to do was, in the spirit of the educational opportunity Steve Darcy outlined for us, what we said, let's look at the real questions we believe need to be asked to really get to this. Okay, reserve developments are happening, of course, but are they a cause of, are they a symptom of, or a lagging indicator of the industry's problems? And number two, is the opinion letter itself serving the industry properly? Of course, what's the role of actuarial practice? Those are the questions that needed to be asked in the midst of that. And so I would contend, at least in my opinion, the S&P article seemed to just dive through these issues. And really, those are the things that need to be examined in the process. Well, the first one, I think it was mentioned fairly aptly yesterday in the general session. A lot of these developments that we see, and if we hold asbestos aside, as S&P was willing to do, many of these relate to the late 90s accident years when pricing projections were, in many people's views, obviously turned out to be full of optimism later. But a lot of those you could easily argue in many cases you didn't see companies make bad reserve moves. They made certain bad business moves, and reserves perhaps are just unraveling the issue now. How good is the opinion letter? How well is this serving our profession when we have our name on something? Is this really where we want to be? And particularly if it's the only document, the public document, that somebody from the outside can get to examine our work and to evaluate us, is this really the proper thing for our profession? And finally, again, is if we have an issue, if there is actuarial practice, some people would contend our methods are no good, that they need to be reexamined, and is this really isolated to certain levels of practice, certain areas, certain lines of business, to a handful of practitioners? What role should we be taking internally to examine what actuarial practice is? Again, very careful contemplation of the questions really needed to take place in this process. So we went about doing some research to get there. As I mentioned, when this scrutiny occurred, a lot of people heard it in a different way. Some saw it as an educational challenge, and I tended to agree with that. Some saw it as a chance to advance reserving methodologies to sell software. They see accuracy in methods as being the biggest shortcoming, and if you just had this different methodology or these different sets of software, you could get more accurate estimates. Well, and then some also wonder if they should ever continue to sign opinions. I know a lot of consulting organizations stopped and took a long look at it. Some decided they didn't want to be in this business any longer, not to mention the fact that the E&O costs were higher than ever. Well, what we wanted to do to look at this matter, we looked at the last 7 calendar years of data, just to begin with, the 2,600 or so companies that filed annual statements. And naturally, we saw, what we tried to do was look at the development of surplus. And so up here, we slotted them
versus the number of companies that we observed that had less than 10% favorable development, between 10 and 5 favorable, between 0 and 5, et cetera, all the way up to those over here that had average development of more than 10% of surplus. Okay, and naturally, as you might expect, there seems to be a general northwest to southeast movement in this chart, and this is where the big issues really come into play. So we're trying to just measure, first of all, how many companies does this relate to? And as you can see, perhaps in 02 and 03 had the most significant, maybe a quarter of the companies that are reporting data here, approximately a quarter, had at least 5% of surplus in adverse development. That has relaxed a little in 2004. That's not quite as severe a situation that occurs with the points that Todd and John had made. But again, part of that has to do with I guess, a favorable accident year that really kind of softened the 2004 calendar year. Anyway, this general movement certainly helps keep in context what's going on. So if we're looking at things like risk and material adverse deviation and written and opinions, yeah, about a quarter of the companies, using retrospect, if you choose 5% of surpluses, some people do, you know, we have quite a bit of material adverse deviation if one adopts such a definition. We also looked at the development as a percent of reserves. And again, no surprise here, the general tendency is significant growth along those areas. But we're just trying to get a feel for what the magnitude of the issues are. So that's our first measurement point. What's going on with these companies and what kind of developments are out there? I'll move forward. Really, $35 billion over 2 years, actually, if we add on the number that Tom had shared with you, $10 billion in the year 2004. It's a $45 billion number over a three-year process, I should say more accurately on the slide. What we wanted to do is find out, since this seems to be at the core of the issue of public perception, what's going on and how do we break these down? So over three different calendar years, 02, 03, and 04, we chose the 30 largest insurance groups, consolidated the companies to the group level, but the 30 largest developments, the largest groups in terms of their 1 year development. Okay, so we're biasing this obviously to larger organizations. We're just taking a look at the magnitude of the dollars of the 1 year development that is reported on Schedule P. And what we found, and I'll share the chart in just a second, is that by 2003, the top 30 pretty much accounted for the entire development in the industry. So we really found the area, I think, that was probably critical, found the groups that we should really be examining. And in 04, we actually found that the developments in the 03, in the top 30 were overall, the industry was better than that, so there were favorable developments among the remaining 2,000 or so companies we looked at. Okay, so what is the real issue? Now this slide is pretty busy, I'm gonna spend some time with it. Go over a lot of the details. This is probably the biggest part of our research. These are the top 30 companies in terms, excuse me, groups, I should say, in terms of their 1 year development. So they're sorted in this manner, of course. The largest thing about a $2.4 billion development. Not so interested in actually divulging names. It wouldn't take people long to probably figure out who these are. This is public financial data. But we don't want to focus on what the organizations are, but just look at what the issues are underlying these companies. Now, the 1 year development test seems to reveal about a $14.5 billion developments among the top 30. Here's the $9.9 billion industry wide. Again, that corroborates with Tom's data. We also looked at what those were in terms of their development on the 2003 surplus from the prior year, and as you can see, it's fairly significant numbers over, but overall, it's about a 12% upward movement. On surplus, or 12% of surplus from 03 was effectively gone by the way of reserve developments. We also looked at the surplus as of 04 and 03, the growth in that number, and also looked at the accident year, 2004, loss and LAE ratio, which we were able to compute just by looking at Schedule B and taking out the effects of reserve development. Anyway, I'll stop right there for now. I'll go here. Also, we were able to study the company and the group to find out what the dominant source was of that development.